Welcome. This is Dr. Kenneth Sherman, Professor of Medicine at the University of Cincinnati. This is an IAS USA module on the diagnosis and management of ascites. Today, I will be covering the following key points of diagnosis and management of ascites. These include diagnostic paracentesis, the analysis of ascitic fluid, basic management of ascites, and the management of refractory ascites. First, we will talk about diagnostic paracentesis. And we'll begin our discussion with candidates for testing. Patients who have new ascites are candidates for testing at the time that ascites are recognized. All patients with known ascites who have an alteration of mental status, which might be attributable to hepatic encephalopathy, those with fever, patients who note increasing abdominal girth, even though they were known to have ascites before, an increase or new abdominal pain, or hospital admission for any reason should be considered as candidates for a diagnostic paracentesis. On the next slide, we will discuss how to collect samples for ascitic fluid analysis. We can divide diagnostic paracentesis into procedures that are solely diagnostic and those that combine diagnostic with therapeutic modalities. The diagnostic procedures can be performed easily at bedside or in an office setting by having the patient sit at a 30-degree angle and identifying a site 1 to 2 centimeters below the umbilicus. In this midline position, there is a relative area of avascularity, which reduces risk of bleeding associated with the procedure. Though most of these patients have evidence of coagulopathy and thrombocytopenia, one does generally not need to consider the use of interventional radiology and the administration of platelets or fresh frozen plasma. Before beginning the procedure, you should plan to obtain an acidic fluid cell count with a differential, and you should plan to culture directly into culture bottles at bedside. This method is much more effective in identifying potentially infectious bacteria in the ascitic fluid as compared to sending samples to the laboratory for subsequent culture analysis. In patients with large volume paracentesis, we often consider a therapeutic procedure. This does not preclude obtaining the diagnostic samples. However, to maximize fluid removal, the patient's abdomen is often entered in the left lower quadrant unless significant splenomegaly is present. A specialized needle called a Caldwell needle is utilized to maximize fluid return and prevent clogging that could be present when one uses a standard catheter. We also typically replace albumin in the patient if the patient's creatinine is increased above normal levels or if the more than 5 liters of fluid are removed. Albumin is replaced at a dose level of 12 grams per liter removed. This does not have to be exact, since this is simply replacement of lost protein. We'll now turn to the analysis of the ascitic fluid that is obtained during this process. As already indicated, in every case, we must have a cell count of the fluid and obtain a culture at bedside, even when infection is not suspected at the time that the tap is performed. In specific settings, and particularly the first time that a tap is performed, there are a number of other tests that are commonly obtained. These include information that would permit one to determine the serum and acidic fluid gradient. One obtains a simultaneous blood sample, which provides information about the serum albumin, and the sample collected of acidic fluid is analyzed for the albumin level. A gradient or SAG of greater than 1.1 is associated with the presence of portal hypertension. If the SAG is less than 1.1, then other etiologies of ascites should be suspected and evaluated. If there is the possibility that the patient has pancreatic ascites, this can be determined by evaluation of the acidic fluid amylase level, with high levels being indicative of a pancreatic source. Total protein is often obtained as a marker of those patients who would benefit the most from prophylactic therapy for SBP, or spontaneous bacterial peritonitis. And finally, if malignancy is suspected as a cause of ascites, then fluid should be collected and sent to the laboratory for cytologic analysis. In the next slide, we will look at the basic criteria for the diagnosis of spontaneous bacterial peritonitis. There will be more about this subject in a subsequent slide set. The diagnosis of SBP can be made by several different criteria. These criteria form a hierarchy. If the patient has a positive acidic fluid bacterial culture from the fluid that is put into the culture bottles at bedside, then this is the best evidence of the presence of SBP. The absolute polymorphonuclear count, or PMN count, above 250 is highly sensitive for the diagnosis of SBP and is indeed the most common criteria that is used, since cultures may be negative in more than 50% of cases. Finally, if a cell count is not available, then the diagnosis of SBP can be made when the total white blood cell count is above 500. At the time the tap is done, there should be no evident intra-abdominal source of infection, such as a perforated bowel with evidence of free air. We will now turn to the basic management of patients with ascites. One of the core treatments for patients with ascites is to begin a low sodium diet, which is defined as less than 2 grams of sodium per day. Patients must be taught to look carefully at food labels and become aware of foods that contain large amounts of sodium but are frequently unrecognized because they are not considered salty. Examples of this might include cheeses, as well as many processed foods that contain high levels of sodium without there being frank evidence of salt present. Patients are typically put on a diuretic regimen. The cornerstone of this regimen is the use of spironolactone, which is typically started at a dose of 50 milligrams per day. Lasix is included in the regimen at a dose of 20 milligrams per day. This regimen is highly effective in the management of ascites, though unlike patients with congestive heart failure, the response to treatment is not rapid, and one must be patient and caution the patient that the response will not be rapid as well. Decisions about increasing the dose should be made at 1 to 2 week intervals and achieve this by doubling the dose of both the spironolactone and the Lasix, ultimately achieving a maximal dose of spironolactone 400 milligrams per day plus furosemide 80 milligrams per day while monitoring creatinine. If the creatinine begins to rise, then the lower dose should be utilized or the treatment temporarily discontinued. During this period of time when dose adjustment and fluid equilibration is taking place, large volume paracentesis can be used as an adjunct to therapy to improve patient comfort and to provide some early ongoing monitoring for evidence of development of SVP. Generally, all patients should be evaluated at least once for any change in ascites or any failure to increase or any failure to decrease overall fluid levels with a Doppler ultrasound, which indicates the presence of clots in the portal system. Portal system thrombosis is very common in patients with a low flow state associated with cirrhosis and can complicate development of ascites, worsening it and making diuretic therapy less effective. We will now talk about the management of refractory ascites. The definition of refractory ascites is the persistent requirement for large volume paracentesis despite either maximally tolerated or peak diuretic therapy as previously described. In this setting, it is clear that the patient cannot be treated with medication therapy and low salt diet alone. At this point, consideration should be given to the use of a TIPS or transjugular intrahepatic portosystemic shunt procedure. We will talk more about that in just a moment. This patient also should be considered for liver transplantation, which ultimately would be curative of most disease processes and significantly reduce portal pressures, thus eliminating the ascites. In the next slide, we see a figure that shows the TIPS process. When TIPS is performed, an intrahepatic shunt is created, connecting the hepatic vein to the portal vein with the use of an expandable metal stent that is driven within the liver between major vessels of the hepatic and portal vein sides. Pressure is reduced because blood flow is permitted to occur freely between the portal vein and the hepatic vein, thus bypassing the liver. This will reduce ascites in more than 50% of patients and may lead to eradication of ascites in up to 30% of patients. Contraindications to the procedure include significant clots in the portal vein or in the hepatic vein. All patients who are considered for TIPS should be evaluated for evidence of right heart failure and for evidence of increased pulmonary artery pressures because the placement of a TIPS in these patients could lead to the development of high output cardiac failure. Patients who undergo TIPS will generally see a significant improvement in their ascites as noted. However, patients who undergo TIPS do have increased shunting, which leads to increased risk of hepatic encephalopathy. Patients who are considered for TIPS who have significant hepatic encephalopathy before TIPS are not considered candidates for therapy. In summary, all patients with ascites should be tapped early and frequently, certainly at each presentation to a hospital for admission. Diagnostic paracentesis is a safe bedside procedure. Cell count and culture of acidic fluid are crucial to the diagnosis of SBP. Low sodium diet, diuretics, and patience lead to efficacious management in most patients. A small percentage of patients will be defined as having refractory ascites, and in those patients, TIPS and liver transplantation may be required for ultimate management.